Coming up, Paul and I discuss unintended consequences, the cost of saying yes, and the role of services, even if you only want to have a product. We extend an offer for you to help track security innovation and talk about some of our plans for the future. And Ron Gula joins us to explain the name of his company, I love that story, and what areas of security excite him. Business Security Weekly starts now.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals, by security professionals. Broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, it's the show about security startups, how to secure your startup, and advice for security startups. It's Business Security Weekly. Need it from the top. Brought to you by, are you getting pressure to improve your data security? Would you like a faster, easier, better way to patch? Then you need to check out AutoMox. AutoMox is a cloud-native platform that patches and manages every endpoint, even remote servers and devices, including Windows, Mac, Linux, and third-party software, from a single dashboard. Improve your cyber hygiene, reduce your attack surface, and save 90% of the effort you spend patching. AutoMox, your patching system of record. Do you have a website, an external presence, employees, an office? Any of these things can be compromised and attacked. How are you defending your assets? Have you penetration tested your public assets? Start 2018 by taking a proactive approach to securing your vulnerable areas. Black Hills Information Security has been helping companies find their weaknesses since 2008. Email consulting at blackhillsinfosec.com and see how they can help you sleep better at night.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back. Business Security Weekly, episode number 82. We're recording it live Monday, April 23rd. I got to tell you what, Mondays, Paul and I were just talking about this. We have so much more energy. We came off a weekend. We're excited to be here, and I hope that translates over into the stuff that you've come to enjoy. We work on focusing on helping to explain the business of security that we might better secure business. That's the whole purpose here, and we want to be your source for trusted insights on leadership and innovation, communication, everything you need to be successful as an enterprise security leader and in the enterprise today, but also if you're an investor or part of the startup grind. I'm still Michael Santarcangelo, your straight-talking guide to help you overcome friction, translate your value into understanding, and joining me back from vacation, looking rested and awesome as always, is my friend and yours, Paul Assadorian.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's good to be here on a Monday. I will echo Michael's thoughts about some of our scheduling changes here and how it's just better for everyone, I think, some of the scheduling changes we made, which is great. I also want to welcome our newer sponsor, AutoMox. It's very interesting. We have this problem. The problem that they solve, we have it here, right? And as we look to improve our IT operations here at Security Weekly, we very much need a solution like AutoMox provides. And now we're a small shop, but what's interesting is our systems that run this show, very, very important systems. They need maintenance. And when you're doing 8 shows a week, it's hard to build that maintenance in. So, you know, drawing from the great solutions from AutoMox and evaluating some others, but, you know, AutoMox is certainly a great vendor in this space. And looking at how to improve IT operations in a lot of different aspects, borrowing from, you know, the Phoenix Project and the great works that have been carried over from auto manufacturing specifically, it's something that we're working on here. So look for more information on this front. I was just looking at their pricing, and it's pretty aggressive. It's pretty awesome. So I'm really liking AutoMox, and I'm looking forward to hear more as we bring them on the show.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. When I played, Paul and I have a way to communicate during the show, and I said, wow, that sounds awesome. I mean, and I'll tell you what went through my head as I was thinking about it. We keep talking about dwell time. We keep talking about how much time it takes to patch. And you and I have had conversations about this throughout the years. But as I was listening to that, and I went, wait, there's a way to automate that? All right. I'm a much bigger fan of this. And I think what we've seen is the whole concept of orchestration and automation is really making dents and benefits. And Ron Gula later is going to join us and talk about that concept of hygiene and some of the stuff that's getting him excited where he thinks we're going to make a difference. And I tell you, it's good. It's all of this is good stuff. So I'm looking forward to it. Now, Paul, you got a webcast this week. So I just want to remind people real quick, April 25th, that's Wednesday. I don't remember what time it is. What is it? 4? Do you remember, Paul? It's 4?
You join a webcaster at 3 o'clock. 3 o'clock.
3 o'clock. The voice is in our head. It's right 3 o'clock. I don't ever try to notice, but the reason I say that is because what I've loved about these webcasts is their conversations. They're real. It's not fluff. It's giving you stuff you want. And this one is with Distill Networks, the year bad bots went mainstream. And you can register still. Go check it out, securityweekly.com/distillnetworks. And as you can see there, it's 1L. It's Distill Networks, 1L. And you can be signed up and you're going to get it's going to be not only entertaining, right? They call it edutainment. You can be educated and entertained at the same time.
Yeah. All right. So Michael, just a quick note on that. John and I are going to talk about the alphabet soup that is existing today in our industry that talks about protecting your web applications and some of the pros and cons of each of those different types of approaches to securing your web applications. And then Distill is going to talk about the bot problem. So like, even if you think you've got it figured out and you're like, well, you know, I've got all these technologies to protect my web applications. And you're like, what do you mean by a bad bot? You're definitely going to want to tune into this because we're going to talk about the strategy. And then a hole in most people's strategy is like basically determining who's a human being and who's a bot. And if it's a bot, is it bad or is it good? And they have like one of the most innovative, I think the most innovative approach to helping you secure your web applications in that light.
That's awesome. That's going to be a lot of fun. And there's a lot there. You know, you were gracious in saying, even if you think you've got it figured out, yeah, we'll see how that works out. Mm. I think you should check everybody out on Wednesday and see how that goes. All right. So the order for today is going to feel a little different. We actually had the chance to pre-record the interview with Ron Gula. So we're going to run that in our third segment. And what we're going to do today is we're going to start with our article discussion. It's been a while since Paul and I got together. This is a chance to just kind of catch up. So just as a reminder, the idea here is what we're looking at are ideas that are either helpful from a leadership perspective, a communications perspective, or an innovation perspective. I typically don't pick things that are relative to security, but the idea then is that these apply. You can be the security leader today. These will apply, even when we're talking about sales. In fact, I would argue more so when we're talking about marketing and sales. If you're in the startup grind or thinking about it, this is good advice for you. Or if you're one of the investors and you're trying to take a look at it, we'll show you some insights into what's happening in the world of security. So this is a chance to kind of talk about it. And the first one I threw in this week, and I'm trying now to be mindful too of what sources I'm pulling from, 4 ways to improve your content marketing. This popped up on Harvard Business Review. It's no secret. I like a lot of their stuff. Paul, here's what I liked about this one. They gave data. I'm finding more and more, if you give me actual data, not just blanket assertions, but break down how things are working out, it's really useful. Here's the thing I got most out of this. It's less than 3 minutes to make an impression. In fact, they broke it down. It's 2 minutes, 27 seconds you have typically in order to do that. Now, we've looked at that with video for years. We've looked at that with writing, and we've looked at the length of writing. There's a corollary to this, though, that was just as exciting to me. It's shorter during the week, but longer on the weekend. So what that means is, during the busy day, during the busy week, somebody's going to look at whatever you've got. They're going to give it about 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes of attention. If they like what they saw, they're going to come back and they're going to spend more time with it on the weekend to try to figure some stuff out. That's when they've got time to get into it and time to read it and everything else. My takeaway on this, I'm curious yours, Paul, but my first takeaway was you can write longer form content still, but it either needs to be paired with shorter form content or it needs to be highly skimmable, where somebody can get to the end of it in 2 minutes or less and go, oh, okay, note, I'm going to come back to this and read it. Now, I don't know about you. I mark a ton of stuff I plan to come back to, and it takes me forever to get to it. So I think the challenge there is, are you relevant enough? Are you exciting enough? Are you urgent enough that they really come back to it on Thursday? A couple other things, and then I'm curious what you kind of pulled out of it. The other two big ones for me, stop worrying about what time of day to send. I still see people trying to optimize. It's Tuesdays at 1 o'clock is the absolute best time. And look, I've fallen prey to that myself. And I've seen studies. This new study came out and they said, yeah, didn't matter. In fact, that's the wrong thing to focus on. Focus on the information that people want. And they said, look, the biggest thing that people read and consume is the case study. It's got an 83% completion rate. That means of all the collateral you're doing. And you know, Paul, in the past, when I've done stuff with the channel, I've always said, I've never talked to a channel partner and said, you know what we need? We need another battle card. I need another sales sheet. Case studies. Why? Why do they matter? Because people want to see what are real people like. And so this, go back, check out the stuff that we did with Sean D'Souza. Talk about testimonials. Talk about, he's got a guide called The Secret Life of Testimonials. It's not just the small little, I loved them. They were the best ever. It's actually, give me the case study. What was it like? How did it work? And I think that that's going to be important. And so it's maybe something that we'll take a closer look at how we can help people do it. But what did you think reading it? Because, I mean, we spent a lot of time looking at this.
Well, I think one of the common misconceptions about content marketing and kind of why it gets a bad rap is that many people believe that, oh, if I just generate some content and I push it out there, everything will be great. Like, everyone will see my marketing efforts and it'll be great. And it's like, no. And I think this article does a great job of saying it needs to be part of your customer journey, as Michael has articulated in the past. I don't know how much on this show, but certainly in our own meetings, very much harping on the point that you need to take people on a journey. And my kind of take on that is it needs to be part of a campaign, right? When I worked in marketing, sure, we had content that we used in marketing, but we always made sure that it was part of a campaign. And we do that today, you know, on our network, certainly, when we help people. It's not just about spray and pray and throwing your content out there. It needs to take people on a journey and it needs to be in a campaign. And I think the third major point is that you have to have some way to measure it.
Yeah. No, and it's why I like things like this, right? They come out and they show us what that things will look like. Somewhere in the course of my day, and I didn't throw it into the notes, it was probably in this particular article. You know, you talked about, a lot of people say, well, if I just write it, if I just create it, people will show. Not necessarily. And to your last point then, measuring it. Do you know? We ask this of a lot of the partners of our program. Do you know what converts? Do you know what moves somebody from that's neat to, whoa, I think I need that? And what's fascinating is when you really get into it and study it, it turns out that usually a very small percentage, very small portion of content does the biggest conversions. So then the question is, why? What did you go figure out? The other thing, of course, is that people are on a parallel track now. So I've never been a fan of that funnel concept. You know, I've talked about that. Mm-hmm. You know, it says like you get all the leads up top and then it keeps squeezing down till they're actually a customer. And wow, it's really exciting. I see it much more as a journey. And what's cool about that is there's no two single paths are the same. Depending on what they know, where they're at in their own context and reality, that kind of brings it all forward. By being able to think differently about how you're presenting and sharing information, you kind of meet people where they're at. And so anyway, that's the stuff I like. Let's talk about unintended consequences. I love this concept. I've always loved this concept. And this is on Shane Parrish's Farnham Street blog. And if you don't read that or get that, it's a great investment. He puts so much effort into it, and you can tell. And, you know, people think I'm reading a lot, and Shane is the kind of person, Shane and Ryan Holiday both make me look like I don't even know how to read. So here's the idea. We have these things called unintended consequences. And this is something, Paul, I figured out when I wrote Into the Breach. I've got a whole section on the human paradox, and then I built the model around it. I should probably dust it off and maybe push it back out there. But the idea was that, you know, we've got actions or decisions that we make, and then we have consequences. But what matters is whether it was intentional or unintentional. And you can have something that's unintentional, but it's actually good, like the way we discovered penicillin, for example. And of course, where we tend to focus on security is all the things that are unintended, and they tend to be bad and sometimes catastrophic. But the reality is, it's okay. So what this article does, and it's a pretty lengthy article, completely worth it, is that if you think, so this typically comes from two things. Either it's more complex than it actually is, like we overthink it. Or the other option is we didn't anticipate it. Like, nobody ever said what could go wrong. It was always what could go right. And we've talked about this. Some companies now do what they call a pre-mortem before they go to launch, before they walk in and go, okay, everybody, it failed. Why? What went wrong? This is like a week out, you know, a month out. And the idea is you kind of want to just stop and say, okay, but what's the range of possible, even if it's not what's desired or what we like? And the idea is to kind of think that through. The one I wanted to point out, and I want to get your take on it, is this idea of the Cobra effect. I heard a story. There was other ones where it's actually been listed for bugs, household bugs and stuff. But the Cobra effect basically said, the government said, hey, anybody who brings us a dead Cobra, you know, there's a reward for that. So what did people do, Paul?
They killed Cobras.
Yeah. And what else did they do?
Brought them to the government after they killed them?
They bred Cobras. Because I can get money by bringing you a Cobra. So what's better than just bringing you a dead Cobra I found? Having a whole bunch of Cobras that I can bring to you every time I need money. So what happens when the government turned off the spigot and stopped paying for dead Cobras? People didn't need their Cobras anymore. So what'd they do with them?
Released them into the wild.
Released them. Guess what we had? More Cobras. You know, and so, and there was the same kind of a concept around flies and dead flies. And there was a, you know, home for boys, and they basically give you a nickel for every dead fly you bring us because they had a fly problem. Well, now the kids were figuring out all these different ways to trap and kill flies from all these different places to try to maximize the return on that. And so, you know, I always look at it in our industry and say, are bug bounties that? Like, are bug bounties helping us or not? And this is not, I don't have a preconceived notion to it. My thought process is always, what's the expected, right? What do we anticipate when a company enters into a bug bounty, or if you're a hunter and you're entering into the other side of that equation and you're taking part in this larger call for a testing process to discover problems? Okay, what's our expected outcome? What's the actual outcome? And what's the marketplace shaping up to be? And where's that going? And how's that looking? I always think it's kind of fun to take a look at that because, like I said, we always look at the negative of unintended consequences, and they can be positive. And then sometimes we don't think about them.
Right.
And that's usually when they bite us.
Well, and I think it's very similar to threat modeling too, right? Trying to understand what the unintended consequences are before they happen is very much threat modeling. I think that kind of shapes into how we view the operations of our systems today. You know, I think Netflix was certainly, and Amazon both, were pioneers in that, to basically have the unintended consequence happen and see how your team and your processes react and then adjusting moving forward. I think that's a super critical part of your IT operations, software development, both today.
And we're seeing a lot of more. Jeez, it's great. So we said Mondays.
Right.
Apparently not more coherent, just more excited about it all. I'm seeing a lot of trends, Paul, where people in the corporate world are exactly pushing for that. What we're seeing now too is if you want your operations to be more resilient and more agile, then you need this, and you also need this, and you also need this. And here's how you make that shift culturally. And we're seeing now more solutions that support it and ease it. And we're seeing insecurity a lot. So I think it's going to keep happening, and it's good. I just think it's a fun conversation to have with people too. All right. Paul, I know this happens to you all the time. Hey, do you just got 20 minutes? Can you give me 20 minutes of time? And there's a cost to this. We've talked about this before. We've talked about polite ways to say no, why you should say no. And so Ryan Holiday went at it from a very personal, slightly different way to say, here's what it costs to say yes. And what he talked about was that he's got like calendar I think he actually wrote anorexia. But like his point was, I don't like to see meetings all over the place. Like it really knocks him off his game. And we talked about we're managers versus makers. I've brought up before Deep Work by Cal Newport. And I'm actually right now putting together some stuff for like a book club for some of the things that we're taking a look at here. And I'm studying some different models on it. This book is and somewhere in the next year or so going to make its way into there. The idea is that if you're a maker, you need space. You need deep, uninterrupted time to just go deep or wide or wherever. But knowing you've got meetings and stuff is kind of frustrating. And I'm finding myself the same situation. For me, what I'm finding now is like my Mondays are my production days and my Fridays are what I call my chaos days. So by moving Business Security Weekly to Monday, this has been great for me personally because now I've got one day a week where I'm really intensely, deeply focused on production, making sure that this show is ready, making sure we're connected with everything, any of the writing that needs to get done, anything. It's all right there on Monday. Good way to start the week. We do this show, feels good, still got time to take calls, but I'm not taking any calls until after this program. So I've got that time allocated when my energy is high, my focus is good, we're putting our most important stuff forward. My Fridays then, I actually also don't schedule time. Now I've taken calls on Fridays, but the ideas on Fridays are I've got time to just catch up, to be deep, to work where I need to go, ramble, or frankly, if I'm fried, it gets to be noon and I call it for an early weekend. And he's trying to do the same thing here. So his point was, it's a compliment. Like people reaching out to you, he was like, when you start out and nobody knows you, nobody wants your time. It's when you've had some level of success that people reach out that they want your time. He's like, but that doesn't mean that you should say yes. And I wanted to point out, because I've started to see this now with a lot of security leaders, and I love the sentiment underneath it. We've been the party of no for so long. No, you can't do that. No, let me tell you what's wrong. Let me tell you what's wrong with that. No, let me stop that. Wait. A lot of folks are going, okay, it doesn't work. I get that. We need to be collaborative. We need what we talked about, influence without authority. We need to go do all these different things. So every time somebody asks, I say yes. Oh. And that's where we end up with 30 priorities. I mean, I'm sorry, folks. I know you think you're the exception. You're not. You cannot be successful with 30 priorities. I'm not even convinced anymore you can be successful with five. I'm really getting down to three. got to have three really good things that you execute on and maybe then completely offload so you can pick up three new things next year. You can argue me you can do more or less, but the idea here is if you say yes to something, then you had to say no to something else, even if you didn't intend to, right? It's like Russia's free will. You know, you can choose not to decide, but then you've still made a choice. Right. Yeah, same thing here. And then he goes on, and I've seen this for years, right? It's 24 hours a day in a period. 24 hours in a day, period. It doesn't matter whether you're rich or poor, whether you're in tech, not in tech, have tech, don't have tech, like it, don't like it. It's 24 hours in a day.
I think one thing that Ryan kind of hints on in this article, Michael, is, and John Willis talks about it in Beyond the Phoenix Project as well, and it's something I was aware of early in my career, and I arguably at different points have done maybe a better job than others at different points, but that is, and this very much in software development is true, and even IT, every interruption is sometimes 2 to 3 times longer than the actual interruption. In other words, if you're in the middle of writing some code and someone comes in to ask you a question and you stop what you're doing, you answer that person's question for 5 minutes, when you go back and start digging into your code, it takes sometimes 15 minutes to like get back to where you were before. That can be a tough thing for folks to really truly understand if you haven't experienced it yourself. But in anything that you're doing, that interruption is much more costly in terms of time than you imagine. So structuring your meetings so that they happen back to back in a certain portion of the day so that you have the rest of the day to then go focus is hugely important. Something that I think we need to do a better job of in general on a lot of different fronts because that interruption is so expensive.
You're right. And it's funny how we don't think about that. Like we get so used to the adrenaline of the interrupt that we've never sat down and said, wait, when I get interrupted from this, something that should have taken me 15 minutes now takes 2 hours.
Yep.
Why? And by the way, the penalty for it's called task switching has an attention residue to it. So the first time isn't as bad as the third or fourth or fifth time in your day.
Oh,
and if you find
true.
That you're getting interrupted as the day goes on,
yeah.
You'll be shot by 3 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of people right now nodding their heads going, yeah. Yeah, it's because there's only so much we can do. I've been experimenting with different ways to structure. And like I said, right now I'm down to the structuring on the wings. But also, you know, when the kids are at school and I block off some time and I sit and I write, oddly productive.
Mm-hmm.
But like trying to write in the evening when they're all trying to do homework, yeah, it's never worked for me. Same concept. All right, Tomas Tungs makes a return back to our blog. I've got to figure out how to get him on our show. So he did this article on why your sales team loses deals. And he went and they looked at, they had all sorts of data compiled, they analyzed it all. And so this excludes competition. So it wasn't, I lost the deal because a competitor beat us out for whatever reason. So let's take that off. 48% of the people lacked the budget to buy. And he's already got a conclusion on this, but I'm going to go ahead and say, you should have known that up front.
Yep.
You should have known up front. 38% had no urgency to buy. I'm going to go ahead and say you probably should have known that up front, if not very early in the process. And 13% lacked authority. I would like to argue that's a surprise, except for I've seen enough places where you can flat out ask if they've got authority, and they will flat out tell you that they do. And then you get there, and they totally don't.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting thing. So here's his takeaway from it. You need to know the budget, the buyer, and the urgency. In fact, what I really liked about this, and it's worth this alone, he lists out 6 basic sales methodologies. In fact, he pulled up a new one in this one that I hadn't seen before. But there's one called BANT. And there's he's got 6 of them that he lays out. And it's all about, right, do you have budget? Do you have urgency? Do you have the need, right, the need for it? Are you the person who can do it, right, the authority? I think BANT is budget, authority, need, and timeline. Mm-hmm. Like, do they have a clear timeline to act?
Right.
His point here is, I don't actually care what you use, but are you qualifying these deals properly? And the reason is interesting. And this, to me, has become the sorting question, Paul. When you and I talk to sales folks, especially when we get the chance to walk the show floor together, you'll always hear me ask this question, right? Like, what leads do you go after and what do you cut? And you watch my reaction when they go, oh, well, I'm looking for this, this, or this. Those I know we can progress. Versus the person who says, oh, well, everybody's a lead. Mm-hmm. No, guys, not everybody's a lead. They might, and so they talk about this a lot in different places, right? And it took me a while to figure this out. And I think it was Anthony Iannarillo who helped me finally get it. You've got prospects, and you've got leads, and they're not the same, right? So leads are basically suspects. A lead means, right, you just went to a show, they scanned your badge, now they've got your email address, and they're going to send something to you. They don't know anything about you. You're not qualified in any way. I don't really know much about you. When I move you from I don't know much about you to now I know more about you, you could become a prospect if the problem that you're trying to solve matches the problem that I'm able to solve. Could be plenty of caveats around it, but at that highest level, that's a prospect. That said, a prospect may not have budget, may not have authority, may not have that urgency or that need, or have any ability to affect a timeline to move forward. When they have that, that's an opportunity. That's the difference between prospects and opportunities. Prospects are qualified to at least experience the problem that you solve, whereas an opportunity is somebody who experiences it, is aware of it, has the budget, the authority, the need, and the ability to move it forward on schedule.
Oh, yeah, I think prospects look good on paper, right? It's kind of a good way to think of it, right? And I mean, we do that in our own sales process, right? We think on paper, this is a great prospect. But I think this article is spot on, dude, with when they talk about lacking budget, urgency, and authority. Those are things that are very difficult to discover on paper, right? I mean, because you can look at a company's revenue, or look at if it's a consumer-based company, the target profile you're going after, the average income, that doesn't necessarily translate to budget. Like, it just doesn't. And that's something you only figure out it when you're in the process of converting them basically from a prospect to an opportunity, is basically qualifying those things like budget, like urgency. Now, the hard part is sales training traditionally teaches you, like, you never ask what their budget is, and you never lead in with your lowest cost offering either, right? I mean, so there's some things in there, but I think this
Well, no, so let's flip that around. That's a perfect segue, Paul. So let's look at this. Does this help you then if you're an enterprise person, right? And I don't mean like, oh, now I know their tricks. What if there weren't any tricks? What if you knew if or what kind of budget you did or didn't have available to you? Because keep in mind, right, if you're an enterprise security leader today, somebody desperate to connect with you, if you were upfront with them and said, look, here's the urgency, right? Think value prop scorecard for a second. Here's the problem I'm trying to solve. Here's the value I'm looking to get to solve that problem. And here's what can or can't impact, right? Here's what'll make or break the deal for me. If you then said to them, okay, I can do that, you know, we might be talking like six figures, and they go, cool, I got a budget of 150. That's it. Listen, if you're a vendor, that's not a signal for I must inflate to 150. That means, okay, they might be a serious person for you.
Right.
And then on the security leadership side, don't be afraid to tell them what your budget is. Look, if you feel like they're running up the numbers just to get your total budget, kick them out the door. Fuck, we'll show you how to do that. Don't waste your time on them. But if you want to get this, then you need to understand too, what's the real urgency? Is this a top three priority for you? And again, you're going to keep hearing me say this because I got a decade of experience with this. Well, Michael, we got 20 priority. No, you don't. It's just simply impossible. What are your top three? What are the top three things that you need to get done? But if you've got something that you need to get done and they're able to do it for you, you know, I don't know. I think we can have better discourse around these types of things. And that's why this stuff matters for me too. I mean, if you've got to try to sell your security program and this person absolutely hates you because you bought something they were trying to, don't waste your time on it. You're not going to convert them. Go figure out the people that are able to influence your deal, that are excited about the potential to work with you, that see it, go spend the time on them. Those are the ones that are going to support you. You can get the budget you want and everything else.
Well, just one last point on that. Budget's kind of a funny thing too, especially when we talk about selling security products. You may have a security product that you know might overextend what the client has claimed as their budget, but you know you're going to save them money in other things. Maybe it allows your team to work more efficiently, and it allows you to not have to renew the subscriptions to like two or three other vendors, or you're not paying maintenance to as much maintenance to one vendor, right? So budget's a very funny thing. It can fluctuate based on the solution that you're offering. And I the best solutions out there, the ones that are the no-brainer, as we say, right? Or go, well, yeah, it's not 150, it's 175, but I'm going to save you 50 based on, you know, the metrics I can show, and you're going to dump this other vendor and your team's going to be 10% more efficient or whatever, right?
Yeah. And by the way, if I can show you 10% more efficient, that's worth it. Which then means, as a vendor, you need to be willing to have that conversation and confident in the value that you can deliver.
Yes.
And as a security leader, you need to be willing to say, okay, well, I can go back and I can ask for more money. Because Newsflash, you can totally go back and ask. If you've been in security and in a leadership position longer than 3 years, I guarantee you at some point somebody's had to come and have the tough conversation with you about how all budgets are being cut by 10% or all hires are frozen or all whatevers are done. Wait, so somebody else unilaterally made a decision that totally impacted you. That means you can unilaterally go beg for more money or, let's be better, make the case for a proper investment that increases value and benefits multiple people at the same time. And P.S., it's $25K more than I put in the budget line for it when I didn't know anything about this.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? Every CIO, CEO, CFO, or executive I've talked to has always told me I would always prefer somebody come and make the case. And I've even said, what if they just spent the $150K and now they got a better solution? Bring it to me, Michael. That's my job.
Mm-hmm.
Make the case. Make me make the hard decision.
The key word there being value.
Yeah.
And that's really the crux of that conversation. You got to be able to show that value. And if you can, the budget's, I mean, I wouldn't say it doesn't matter, but it's less of a factor if you can show that value.
In fact, if you show that value and you follow, and so I'm going to promise you right now, I'm going to jump for a second. A lot of you have written in recently about the value prop scorecard stuff. You've had good questions on problem and asked for examples, good questions on value, good questions on impact. We're going to have a conversation in the next segment around this. And I can tell you right now, we are going to put together some segments that not only answer the questions, but demonstrate that and show you what that looks like. So stick with us, but that's the same thing here. I think this is connected to it, Paul. So, and this is fun. This is TechCrunch. It actually came across, last couple of days. The case for boosting enterprise software startups with services. So here's the way this kind of works, and I think it fits into what we're just talking about here. If you're looking at deals, you're trying to look at how this type of stuff works. I'm going to start on the enterprise side for a second and then show you why this matters. You're already pedal down. You're pushing as hard as you possibly can. Maybe you got the friction. Maybe you don't. By the way, if you think you don't, it just means you don't know where it is yet and you haven't found it. So what happens then is you come along, you see this technology, go, oh, that'd be cool. If you've got some experience, you go, wait, that's going to be cool. How am I going to implement that? How long is it going to take to integrate that? What are the surprises I don't know about? And how do I really get the value that they're asking me for out of it? If you're an enterprise, that means for you, it might be good, right? So OpEx versus CapEx. OpEx is your operating expenditures. CapEx is your capital expenditures. Typically, this would be like if you look at a building, it's the cost of building the building versus cleaning and maintaining the building. When we look at it for security, it's the difference between buying hardware and software. Although software can kind of go either direction depending on how you classify it, and getting help for it. And so the argument here is a lot of times you can de-risk your investment in any sort of solution, certainly a startup solution, by bundling some services with it. Now, what we talk a lot about here on innovation is, well, but hold on, if you're trying to run a business today, it doesn't scale too well. Now, I've got a background in consulting. Consulting, first of all, scales pretty well. And if you're defined enough, if you're niche enough, right? If you're one of the large ones like Accenture that we worked with a little bit last year or such, you command a premium for a lot of reasons, not the least of which are some of the great things that they talked about in terms of their investment in innovation and training and mentorship and everything else. And I got to tell you, I learned a lot in my time with what was, Anderson Consulting, Accenture, and it was great. But traditionally, if what you're trying to do is start a product, then offering services around that product often becomes a distraction. You don't make as much money. You don't scale as well. It's not really what your intention and your purpose was. So a lot of people say, nope, absolutely don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it. And the argument here is actually you should think about it. And the simplest reason, and they list, like they really break down all sorts of stuff. But here's what I thought mattered, especially when it came to security. You're trying to do something that's complex and you're trying to put it in. Now, remember, we just talked about complexity and the biases that we have for complexity that lead to unintended and unanticipated consequences. What I found, and we've talked to a couple companies that have done this, that they kind of let out with, well, we've got a product, but I'm not exactly sure how to make it work that way. Here, I'll sell you some services. And as the services engagement started figuring that out, they talked to the developers who built different stuff into the platform, who then were able to sell it. And then, a couple years later, they say, hey, look, our 8.0 release, it can do this for you. You don't have to pay for our services anymore. The argument here and the risk is it can help you better figure out your product market fit. It can better help you figure out perhaps even your MVP. And it means that people are spending money on it. It's a way to de-risk it, to get in there, to get the experience to it. I'm going to just sum up all of their pros and cons to it and say, here's the caveat or here's the what you need to think about doing it. How do you do it in a way that benefits your best customers and pulls them into that ability to define the pathway and figure out all the implementation and improve your product, but doesn't become the sole source of revenue. Like, you don't want it to be the recurring number. You want the recurring number to be the product and the subscriptions, right, and everything else. This is the startup. And then eventually, you know, I would either say you have a small team that handles it or you push it off to partners. Now, Paul, I got to think about this. You and I have asked a lot of people in the product development side, like, how do you know what features to add or not to add? And how do you know when to do it? And I think this is a way to do that. It's keeping you engaged with your partners, with your trusted clients and stuff. But, you know, I've been thinking a lot about Sean D'Souza and the idea of the target profile. And if you go back and you check out that interview, he really breaks into, you're talking about a person, not a composite, which he calls a Franken profile. You want a person and to do an interview with that person, understand it. And I actually think that's the secret. I think that if you're in product management today or the content marketing or anything else, don't worry about the persona so much as go find the whoever's closest to your ideal client and really get to understand them and their particular needs. The ones that are most closely aligned to the ideal client are the ones I put services on, because chances are, you know, working with 2, 3, 4, 5 of those folks, that's going to get you the insight that you need in order to grow your business. I think that's where they all start to come together.
You know, and we've covered so many different companies, Michael, that are either no services, like you can't call anyone at Google.
Well,
I
mean, right.
You could try, right? But, you know, I mean, that's a very hands-off model, all the way to, you know, you mentioned Accenture, which is all about consulting, but there's everyone else in between. And it's not a black and white issue, right? I've seen services companies that have spun up products, and I've seen product companies that have offered services, and sometimes it's been successful, sometimes not. And I think that as a, you know, a business owner or business leader or a consultant, right, you need to be able to navigate those waters. And I think everything Michael just covered is really a lot of the different variables you have to work with. And I don't believe it's a black and white kind of issue, right? It's not like you have to either be products or services. No, there are some models that could work for you in either direction. And again, I've 14th year covering this industry, right? I've seen a lot of companies make those decisions for good, bad, or indifferent. And you got to read that article and listen to what Michael is talking about with respect to this article to really make that decision. And the journey and the path in that decision is going to be different for everyone. And so, you know, hopefully it works out for your organization, whatever you choose. But I think the important point here is don't discount it in either direction. Maybe you need to dump your services. There are companies that did that just recently. I hope it works out for them. There are other companies that are spinning up services. Hope that works out too, right? And I've seen it go, you know, all kinds of different directions. So there's no real solid, concrete answer. It's different for everyone.
I like that. So if you're watching, we're about to take a quick break, but write to us. Let us know who you think's getting the balance right, or if you think somebody's maybe making a mistake. We're not going to bash them on this program, but I'd at least like to know, and we could track it and figure it out. With that, when we take our break, you can go to securityweekly.com. You can check out all the shows we've got. This is just one of many. Something for everybody, maybe everything for someone. I don't know how that would work out, but we got lots of options. Securityweekly.com. Check us out. You can send us feedback. Let us know what you think. And when we come back, we'll talk about what the quiet week of innovations meant for us in terms of reflection with an invitation for you.
Domain Tools help security analysts turn threat data into threat intelligence. They take indicators from your network, including domains and IP addresses, and connect them with nearly every active domain on the internet. Those connections drive risk assessments, help profile attackers, guide online fraud investigations, and map cyber activity to attacker infrastructure. Fortune 1000 companies, global government agencies, and leading security solutions vendors use the Domain Tools platform as a critical ingredient in their threat investigations and proactive defenses. For more information, visit securityweekly.com/domain tools. Today's determined attackers easily bypass even the most advanced network defenses. Trying to ramp up staff to detect their backdoors can cost thousands of dollars and take months, even years. With Active Countermeasures AI Hunter, we enable junior analysts to detect even the most advanced backdoors in a matter of hours. Sign up for a demo and purchase our product today by visiting activecountermeasures.com/BSW. Active Countermeasures, make every analyst a hunter.
All right, now it's time to talk about some innovation. Last week, of course, 16 updates, 5 exits. It was crazy. It was the week of RSA. This week, nothing.
Crickets.
Not a thing going on. So some stuff there to talk about. Don't forget, though, check out our on-demand material. So we, Paul and I, are just talking about content marketing and the way that we're trying to help everybody. One of the things people have asked for is, hey, can we have more stuff? We love the live stuff that you guys are doing, but can we come check out some of the other things that you've done or some other forums? And you can get that now, securityweekly.com/on-demand. Check it out. Give us some feedback. Let us know what we can do to help you out even better. All right. So the one article that I picked before we get into some discussion about RSA and the value prop scorecard, it was interesting because this came across TechCrunch and said, in the enterprise startup scene in New York City, security is job one. And so I'm going to just kind of summarize it. But I think what's really interesting is this one quote that I pulled. It's startups who have been established in New York because that's where their primary customers are most likely to be. It's got a whole list of companies in there, things that we can explore. We'll go wherever you want, Paul. But what I thought was kind of interesting was it was another one of these articles that says, look, you don't have to be in Silicon Valley. And right. Actually, I think Boston is a hotbed of technology.
It is.
DC is a hotbed of technology, especially in security. Atlanta and Austin.
Austin, yeah.
And a lot of people then, you know, and if you do this enough, people go, well, don't leave out New York City and you can't leave out Chicago. Yeah, no, I know. I got it. All the major cities. What this was saying, though, is that actually what's a little bit different about the startup world in New York City is that it is focused on security and it's focused on enterprise level security because they have financial markets and banking and healthcare. Like basically I've lived in New York City. I'm partial to it. So it's one of the biggest, best cities in the world. But if you know, make it a top 10, if it makes you happier, there's a lot of stuff going on there that makes it necessarily vibrant. And no, it's not all the it's not the startups you're going to see in Silicon Valley. These are going to be enterprise level stuff because they can get on the subway and go meet with their customers face to face, figure stuff out, get it going, et cetera. And I just thought, yeah, it's worth pointing out. You can be here in Myrtle Beach. You can still, we've got a couple startups in the security space that are here in Myrtle Beach. You can find them anywhere. So anytime you read this doom and gloom, stop. It's no there. But let's talk about doom and gloom for a second. And it's probably not the nicest of segues on my part. But listen, Paul and I spend a lot of time talking about the industry. We've been doing this for a long time. And as you can see, we're still both optimistic about it. I don't know if Paul went through the trough that I went through, but I'm out of it. I'm feeling good about it. So we look at RSA. It's a show I've been to. It's a show I like. It's also a show that confuses me. There's so much there. It feels so overwhelming. There's thousands of people on the show floor. And I've always felt like it's just a cacophony of noise. In fact, it's a cacophony of noise. And so I've always wondered, you know, as a vendor, do you do it? And we've had some vendors say, well, I mean, Michael, it's a tax. I mean, you know, it's like you got to do it. You got to be there. So my question is that true? Do you see that? Do you see that as a vendor? Do you see that as an enterprise security leader? Paul and I didn't go this year. And it's not the first of many years. Like I go sometimes, typically if there's a reason for me to go. But here's what I noticed. Leading up to the show, Paul and I talked for weeks about how this is a great week to talk about stuff that you're doing. And we had some and they got good coverage. Last week, I had to do 16 updates, including 5 exits, all because people wanted to time stuff around the show of RSA. I'll be brutally honest. I don't really remember too many of them. Like, okay, cool. They were there. Wow, we covered a lot of stuff. It turned out even for me, focusing on stuff, a lot of that stuff was noise. And this week, crickets. Paul, what a great week to tell me about something awesome that you're doing or some cool way of solving a problem. So what do you think? I mean, is it just that we're putting too much emphasis on the shows, too much emphasis on a single show? Is it still the best way to meet people? What do you think?
I think that obviously, you know, folks find value in attending, and whether you're attending as an attendee and you're looking at the vendors for purchase, or you're a vendor and you're looking to do marketing and sales, anytime you have a show that large, I think you're going to find value. Now, whether you found enough value, that's a question you should be able to answer that I find not everyone is able to answer. But if, you know, you're in front of that large audience, you probably got some booth traffic and there's enough people there that hopefully you converted some sales to cover your marketing spend and make it worth your while to be there. So I think that's why, I guess, Michael, to answer your question, like, you know, some people look at it as a tax. I think in a show that large, you're probably going to find some people in your target audience. I think the hard thing that you're referring to is, how do I get above the noise? And more importantly, how do I get the right people to visit my booth and talk to someone? And even if I do, how do I differentiate them when they're standing at my booth to know that they're the right person or not? I think it goes back to your previous article, which I thought was awesome, about how do I know who's got the budget and the urgency and the authority that comes to my booth? And that's something that I think all vendors struggle with today. And that's why, you know, there are other programs that you can do to help your marketing and sales efforts that let you cut right into that target audience, which you probably need to do in addition to doing some of these conferences as well. That's kind of
well. All right, so I think you're bringing up a good point. You know, if you go look at this traditionally, a lot of the companies know that a face-to-face meeting is going to make a difference. So if they look at, I'm going to put two or three people, travel, airplane, you know, trains, planes, automobiles, and I'm going to get them to you, and you're going to get maybe a 1 hour to a 2 hour meeting. Maybe you'll let me buy you lunch, and they add up the cost of that versus what if I'm just at RSA. And I can bring my whole team, and, sure. and over the course of a couple of days, we can do a lot of meetings.
Yep.
All right, there's an efficiency to that. I get that. And I think what you keyed on, though, is what's really important. How are you driving the right people to you? How are you maximizing that investment? And maybe finding some of those things that you didn't expect, but gosh, they're awfully useful. I've always been impressed by the teams that actually map out, whether it's RSA or it's Black Hats, even Source Boston, any of these things, they map out who they want to talk to and why, what talks they're going to go to and why. But then what I've never seen, or let me say what I've seen sporadically, is somebody will go, they'll take really good notes and they'll share them, right? They'll put them on the company SharePoint or they'll talk about it someplace or whatever else. And I always go, that's great. Do you always do this? And they go, no. Okay, but why not? Like, I think if it sounds like I'm down on it, I read a quote this morning from somebody else who runs a higher end, smaller focused private event every year. And they said, you know what? We don't have a hallway track because it's peers. It's not a presentation. It's not a didactic kind of a thing. It's much more of a, we're going to sit and work on stuff collaboratively with some real known bona fide experts in the room to make a difference. And they're like, you know, that's awesome. And I always feel like a lot of times in security, we don't do that because we're much more excited about, yeah, but we had the hallway and there were some great parties and there was some cool stuff and I got some neat swag and I got to meet some really cool people. I'm not knocking any of that. But my point is, I'm going to go back to what Paul said. I can see a lot of value being in a place where you're going to have, was it 30,000 attendees, more, less? Let's say some large number of people. The questions then you start saying, what's the percentage that might actually be what I need? That'd be great. Now, I'm going to add in two things that Paul and I talk about all the time. So I'm curious, if you're, whichever side you're on, vendor, investor, enterprise security leader, somebody interested in being a leader, just let us know your take on these two things. But what I've always looked at is, this is where as a program, we can help showcase some of the people that are there and the types of conversations you can expect to have with them. And so it's that looking at, I don't just need to go to the show. I need to sell people on the fact that I'm going to be at the show. And then instead of saying I'm going to be at RSA or wherever, here's why you should come engage with me. Here's what we can talk about. And I've only got X number of slots and they need to be used properly. But then I think flip side around, if you're at one of these shows, I mean, what I've always enjoyed, Paul, from these shows are just some of the awesome conversations that you can have. Well, if you're in an organization and you have one of those awesome conversations, you need to magnify that, you know, and if you're finding that there's a trend because you've brought your A team and they're having a great time and they figured some stuff out, that's the stuff everybody else is interested in. Well, where are you sharing that? And how are you getting that story out in context? And what does that lead people to? And I always feel like we treat this as a one-off event, not as part of a consistent, coordinated effort. And I think that's where we can do better. Or I've got a lopsided view of the way things are.
Well, I think you need to define what you want to get out of the show before you go, right?
And good point.
It's not always about just sales, too. And certainly I've been in a lot of different organizations. And sometimes you'll do an event at the event, and the goal for that might be different. You're like, yeah, we have a booth. People come by. We're evangelizing about our product. That's great. Might drive some sales, might get some leads, might be a lead that's already in the system that we're able to nurture a little better. Great. But we may do another event alongside the event. Maybe we have some people speaking. Maybe we have a party. Maybe we do a breakfast, a dinner, whatever it is. And some of those goals aren't necessarily sales related, but it should speak to the company's growth. Maybe some of the people we invite to our event, maybe they're potential partners, maybe they're potential content creators, and we're making and forming connections with others that can help our organization with respects to growth. That isn't always sales. Sales are great. Sales are nice. We need sales, like, not disputing that. But maybe we talk to some content creators and they're going to help us with our content marketing plan, or we talk to some other vendors that want to partner with us, or we just got advice from some investors that we, you know, had dinner with or whatever. So I think there's a lot of that I think should be the reasons why companies are attending and putting a strategy behind attending the events. And I think where it falls short is if you don't have a strategy and you don't have goals and you're just going to the event, you know, setting up a booth and just going, yeah, people are going to come to us.
Yeah. And they're going to love it, right? We're going to win them over on the merits.
Right.
I'm going to show them a demo and mm-hmm. they're going to give me 20 minutes. And it's like, wow. Okay. All right. Like I said, I'm not knocking it. I'm interested in how does the good stuff get above the noise? How do we connect people? How do we provide a service for our audience and for our partners and the people that we've selected to work with, and how do we connect the dots better? Kind of leads us into this value prop scorecard. So I created a framework called Straight Talk. And those of you who are asking again, yeah, the update's coming. I know I keep saying that. Just assume hopefully this year. If not, you can all get together and kick me enough till I get it done. But I've been learning a lot in how to simplify. And so a couple months ago, maybe a year ago, we figured out that there's a value prop that's just asking the first three questions. And we ask them all the time here. What problem you're trying to solve? What's the value created solving that problem? Or what value do you create solving that problem? And then what's the impact? And the impact is really that measure of friction. And that's why a bunch of you have kind of asked for some examples on that. And so stick with us. That's coming. Paul, here's the thing I started to figure out. And I've shared some of the stuff with you in the past too, is I came up with like a rubric, a way to measure a value prop. And you know, I tried to be like all scientific-y and excited about it. And here's what it came down to. Yeah, it was overwhelming. And really just being able to figure out what problem you're trying to solve was just kind of too much for people. So I kind of went back through my notes and all my experience, and I came up with, well, what if I could help you with five questions? So the three questions of the value prop and two filters. Mm-hmm. And by assessing it, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, that you can kind of get a direction of, right? So like, what problem are you trying to solve? Is that clear? No. And do you have that problem? No. Then don't continue. Right. There you go. Right. Now you get your time back. Or what, you know, is it clear the problem you're trying to solve? Yes. Are you the person responsible for that? You know, I don't know. I don't know is a no. But in that case, you might circle it and go, all right, I got to go do some investigation. Good. Now you know where to focus. So the idea is really simple. You know what to end or what to say yes to, or at least where to focus your best next steps. And what I found working with people was that clarity really works. All right. Well, Paul and I, we've mentioned this now. I've mentioned this a couple times. And of course, I did it right going into a vacation. I got a bunch of email about it and I loved it. And I think I've responded to everybody. And if I didn't, I'm really sorry. Send me another note. But people say, hey, this is really useful. Like we want to use this for vendors and whatever else. And so what we've been talking about is, look, I found three basic uses for it. The obvious one is the vendor. And you and I have talked about that. And I'll just be really upfront and really transparent. Paul and I are looking at some ways that we can get this in your hands if you're in the enterprise side of stuff so that you can better start evaluating some of the vendors that you're evaluating or the vendors that you're working with. And we're even exploring how you could take this to a show floor and work it out. And some of you have asked for that. So it's great. So not terribly surprising. But what we've realized then is that if we do that and we can figure out a way to work with you, then we have better insights that we can share as part of this program. It'll give us some ideas on where we need to focus and potential partners and the whole bit. So good stuff there. But what I've also realized using this with other people is that's only one way to use it. I'll give you two other ways you can use it really fast. Internal projects. Go back to the thing we just talked about. You feel like insecurity because somebody reached out. You can't possibly tell them no, because they might not reach out again. What if I could show you how you could score that in 5 minutes or less in a conversation and figure out, yeah, we should totally have this conversation, or I think it's really good. Now, gracefully getting out of it might be a different situation, but I can at least get you some clarity on that. And then the other option, of course, is just for your own stuff. I've been fortunate to work with a number of security leaders and their teams over the last year where just those three questions were pretty good sorting function. So, in the rest of looking at this, right, from an innovation perspective, because one of the things that Paul and I have kind of stopped doing are like our journey updates and everything else, but we're still both actively running startups and working together to make this Business Security Weekly program better. And so recently I've done the interviews with NSwarm, and I was really kind of blown away, and that came through one of our listeners making that suggestion. So big exciting stuff there, which then connects us to NSwarm, which then connected me to Dan Wheatley. And Dan was our interview a couple episodes back and talked about all the evidence-driven marketing. Well, that got Paul and I pretty excited, so we're going to talk with Dan later. And then Dan, I reached out to Dan and said, hey, how would this work on the scorecard side of stuff? So right now, if you go to securitycatalyst.com/scorecard, and maybe we'll try to make it so whichever of the security sites you go to, if you're working with us, you've got what you need. But what Paul and I are going to do is we're going to advance what we're just calling the simple value prop scorecard. And what we're going to focus on is how to use it for vendors, for yourself, for internal projects and stuff like that. And what you're going to see, so I'm going to start rolling this out over the course of the next week. So if you go to securitycatalyst.com/scorecard, sign up. I'll let you know when we get started on it, and that's going to get you some additional conversations. We're going to try some NSwarm sessions, and you can get some early access to that technology and see what that's like. And we're going to work with Dan Wheatley to start to figure out what people need, what they want. And because of you working with us, it's going to develop out what that scorecard looks like and how to use it. And then that's going to feed back into what we're doing for segments here at Business Security Weekly, as well as things that you'll see from all of Security Weekly when you work with us or attend the different shows and stuff like that. So that's kind of where we're at. And it's this idea. I mean, it's a very blunt. You're invited to help out. You can collaborate with me and with Paul. You can help out. You can help us define this. Frankly, you can tell me the parts that are working, the parts that are confusing. And what I've kind of learned in this whole process, Paul, you know, we always like read the stories like, you know, if you're slightly uncomfortable, it's time to ship. Yeah, I've passed that. Like, we just need to get this out in people's hands and then give you the ability to start engaging with us, with me and with us on what's working and not working. And in, you know, 60 to 90 days, I think you're going to see this is going to create some new programming that really allows us to structure some conversations in our industry differently. And if not, I want to know about it so that what we're advancing is really useful. But Paul, I mean, you were just telling me you recently talked to somebody and we don't have to name them if you don't want to, but you asked those basic questions. They had answers. You were kind of pumped. They were kind of pumped. And
yeah,
it
and
makes
that's
things
just one of the things fueling basically Michael and I's work on. I mean, Michael's fueling our work with these questions in a lot of different situations. Lenny Zeltzer from Minerva Labs, you know, I asked a basic set of five questions. Lenny did a fantastic job of answering them. I'm like, wow, that's exactly the information that I'm looking for. It's probably the information that our listeners are looking for. So there's a lot of different, you know, perspectives on this. Since Michael's been working more with this, and basically there's a couple of things that are driving it from my perspective. One is we have our first full-time salesperson. It's going to be doing some other things for us in addition to sales, but that our salesperson, Joe, has no background in security. So he has to understand, you know, what questions to ask and what answers are you know, on a scale and basically rate people. So I'm like, well, I have to write questions for Joe so he can start doing some basic stuff and do a knowledge transfer with him. Also, you know, we're taking on more of an analyst role as time goes on here at Security Weekly. And so there's more than just me that are going to shows and talking with vendors. And I was like, well, I really want all the Security Weekly hosts to be able to go talk to a vendor and maybe have some standard way to ask questions and score answers. And I'm like, well, Michael has that. So then I took what I've learned over time from Michael and from just doing these analyst calls in different capacity. And I started documenting all my questions. And Michael's like, well, why are we asking all those questions? I'm like, that's good. I should write down why we're asking them. In fact, Jeff going to RSA is like, these questions are good. But he's like, but why am I asking them? Also, it may be good for the person answering to know why we're asking them as well. So the point is, we're working on all this research and we're going to share it. And we've got the, you know, kind of first take on that. And it's going to evolve. I'm super excited because I get to basically take everything we're doing with vendors and start to organize it and put it in consumable pieces, right? Because sometimes I talk to a vendor and it's in the sole light of, are they a partner, potential partner for the show? Do they want to sponsor? And what type of sponsorship is appropriate for them? I may also, in the same conversation, maybe different, say, okay, tell me about your solution. Like, where does that fit in the market? What problem do you solve for people? Why is that important? And understand what they do to evaluate them as a vendor to make recommendations. And then there's different ways we'll ask those questions. Like, are we at a vendor trade show floor? Is it a phone interview? Do they want to do a briefing with us at a conference? And then what do we do with that information? So I'm having a lot of fun documenting this whole process, Michael, and I'm excited that we'll have portions of it that our audience can use to evaluate vendors. I think it's great.
Yeah, you said something I want to touch on too, because I think it's really important. You know, we've looked for years at this concept of templates, and I've come down to just calling them recipes, but it's a distinction between frameworks and system. A framework basically gives you an outcome, an element, and then the connections between them, versus the system, which shows you how to achieve that particular outcome. So when we ask what problem you're trying to solve, framework level question. How you get to a consistent answer on that, that's a system level question. What matters then in this is at that framework level, and the reason that I'm really keen on sticking to the three core framework level questions and then two qualifying filters around it is that it's the kind of thing then where, again, over the next 6 or 8 weeks, I'll make sure that what we've laid out is so clear and consistent that anybody who does that, can they can access it either from within the tool itself, or they can come to the website and they can look at it and go, oh, I see what you're trying to ask me. Oh, I can go look at the case studies and examples, all the stuff we talked about today, and I can see those particular potential outcomes. And that gives us really good broad-based stuff. It's not asking the question that's as important as it's knowing why you're asking the question and where it fits into the overall framework. That's how we overcome that friction, translate that complexity. And what I love then about our work is that we get to do that at Security Weekly. And you know, and watching as you're working through that process is giving me insights into how to do that. And so what I'm going to do is just take the very pointy tip of that spear and make that available for everybody who's part of our community. And then start learning from that. But then I'm going to get some firsthand experience working with you too to say, okay, what does this lead to? If right, so like it might. So in our case, it might not be five no's is a no. Five no's could be here's where we start.
Right.
Here's some other things we need to know. Here's where you fit. And so that stuff is all that like this stuff to me gets really exciting, and the opportunity to share that with people. You know, look, I got to tell you, for years I've hated. I still hate that false scarcity, right? I'm only selling this till Thursday.
Yeah.
That drives me bonkers because I know it's fake. As well as people who are like, I'm going to be, right? I don't mean to be too mocking, but you see a lot of people who are like, I got rich on the internet and you can too. Here's my income statement for the month. And I'm going to do that every month to show you how rich I am. And you can, you know, okay, that stuff drives me crazy too. But being able to sit down and say, okay, we've been listening. Paul and I have been doing this for 20 years. We've worked as analysts. We've worked as consultants. We've worked on all these different sides to it. And we're hearing it. And it's interesting because we're kind of in the middle going, you're all trying to solve a similar problem, but you're going about it slightly different ways. Oh, we can bring you together. Wow. Hey, we're going to break down how we're doing it. We're going to share it and we're going to invite you to participate with us. And you can check that out. And there'll be more, right? So there'll be more updates in the next week or two. And then we'll get into some sort of a monthly cadence.
Yeah,
and we'll see where it goes. But I get pretty excited about it.
I like the ability to kind of customize it for the situation. Like I've noticed, Michael, that sometimes... Yeah.
Those are the filters, Paul. That's like right. When I talk about a recipe, it's like there's core questions you have to ask, and then you can filters. Filters and are based
on
the situation.
What I've realized recently this year is that sometimes leading in with what problem you solve, I'm like, well, I really do want the answer to that question, and sometimes it's not really my first question, right? And I found that at the trade show floor, that question's way too overwhelming for people, and I want to get to it. And like you said, there are some other filters that allow us to work towards getting the answer to that question. And it's about understanding your audience and understanding the situation that you're in, right? Like it's not a scheduled briefing call. It's not an interview on the show. We're not prepping for that. Like if I'm just showing up to the person's booth, there's some tweaks that we're making to the questions, right? And if it's a phone screening for a particular purpose, it's the same premise, but there's some tweaks we're making to the questions. And I love making these tweaks, right?
And you just keyed in on exactly why. It's a framework. You know you need to be able to answer. And by making this the simple scorecard, you need an affirmative or a negative. They got it. They didn't get it. That's it. How you get there,
right?
The journey can be different. And that's where our collective experience is going to be a lot of fun because we get a chance to say, okay, but here, I mean, look, I love it when you and I get a chance in person to go visit booths. Like it's got to be entertaining for them too. But we're not jerks about it because we actually want the insight. So we'll walk you down the path. We'll help you get there. We've got a pretty diverse skill set in doing this, just helping more people do that. But by the way, you've commented to me that you've shown up to some booths that have watched the program and said,
yes.
Hey, I'm ready for
that's
you. I've got my answers. That's jackpot. So if we could start getting to the point where vendors felt comfortable having answers and the enterprise leaders and the enterprise folks getting out there and having those conversations, if we can trim some of the noise away and get people down to what matters faster, cool. And I want to learn, just like you pointed out, from where people are going with it. So this is one of those things that's kind of exciting because I get to do something I'm really passionate about. It's benefiting our work here at Security Weekly. It's benefiting our industry, and we can talk about it on Business Security Weekly at the same time. Oh, cool. It's a good win. So, all right, well, let's take a break. And speaking of all the ways to engage with us, you can go to facebook.com/securityweekly. You can check us out. You can like us because it makes us feel better. But actually, what you're going to start seeing from us is all these different things that we're creating, both on YouTube and Facebook, that you might have missed on the main network. Now you get your chance. You can keep in touch with us. You can network with your peers. You can see all sorts of other stuff. Facebook.com/securityweekly. It'll keep you informed of everything. And when we come back, we're going to share our pre-recorded, formerly live interview with Ron Gula and why it's called Tech Adventures.
Are your existing solutions able to take advantage of real threat intelligence? Common solutions like firewalls weren't designed to handle the massive and growing volume of threat indicators. This challenge often results in significant gaps in your protections, even when you think you have it covered. You need to protect yourself by filtering network traffic against unique threat indicators in a way that allows you to act. Palowall by Bandura Systems is the solution that filters over 10 million indicators right out of the box. Developed with the Department of Defense, Palowall is affordable for companies of all sizes. Get your free trial at BanduraSystems.com. Rapid7 powers the practice of SecOps. Using shared data, analytics, and automated workflows, SecOps unites IT, DevOps, and security teams to make security an outcome of innovation. Rapid7 combines technology, expertise, and advocacy to drive vulnerability management, application security, incident detection, and log management for more than 7,000 organizations worldwide. Power up your SecOps practice with a free trial at rapid7.com/securityweekly.
All right, as promised, we're going to give you our featured interview with Ron Gula. A lot of you know Ron because of his time with Tenable. He has turned into a fantastic investor, still very excited about the security space. So he sat down with Paul and I. He was actually in studio, so he sat down next to Paul, and I joined in. And we're going to run that interview for you a second, in which he answers the question, why is it called Tech Adventures as opposed to investments or whatever? And you're going to like the answer. Just remind you quick, Source Boston, we just got talking about shows and how to make the most out of the shows. Source Boston is going to be May 9th to May 10th. If you go to sourceconference.com, you can register using our code SW75WMKW. It's on your screen. You can come to our show notes at securityweekly.com and get that. That's going to get you a $75 discount. And you can take some of our advice from today. You can scope out the vendors that are going to be there that you want to talk to. You can prepare to have good conversations with them, think about the talks, how you want to act on it, how you want to do better, set your intention, set your purpose, and you can meet the Security Weekly team when you're there. All right, because it's a pre-recorded interview, we're going to roll into it, and I will see you next week. I am at Catalyst on Twitter. Paul is at Security Weekly on Twitter. We love hearing from you. We love engaging. You can find us on LinkedIn or the Contact Us page. Send us a note. Let us know what you think, what you'd like to see more of. All that feedback goes into the programming and a lot of great stuff we got coming your way. But till then, we'll see you next week, 1 p.m. Mondays. Facebook, YouTube, you can catch us live. We'll engage if you're there with us. Let's have our conversation now with Ron Gula, talking about where he's still excited about tech investment and security investment in specific, some of the things that he does and doesn't look for. And he talks about attorney-client privilege, which if you didn't catch, we talked with Sean Tuma about last week on episode number 81. You're going to love the way this all comes together, and we'll see you next week. So we're going to have an opportunity to sit down with Ron Gula, the president of Gula Tech Adventures. And we'll ask him about that if you don't know why, but it's a perfectly named company. But one of the things we look at a lot is risk and how we're managing risk. And then we can probably do a little bit better and talk about the efficacy of our efforts or the efficiency of our efforts. And it was a conversation we had just started before we decided to record. So, hey, let's talk about that. So Ron and Paul are in studio. Welcome back to Business Security Weekly, Ron. In fact, last time you were here, I think it was called Startup.
That's so what it was, yeah.
Welcome to the change.
Good to be back.
Welcome to the new face called Business Security Weekly.
I like the new face.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. I mean, we changed the name and a little bit of our focus, and I think everyone's been digging it. So, Michael, yeah. If you want to, kind of start us off and
for a little bit more background too for Ron. So he's been on the program, but founder of Tenable, good background in the industry prior to that, and understands the investing side of it. So kind of like perfect guest for Business Security Weekly, where, and Ron, the way we explain this to a lot of people now is it's what we're trying to do is take a look at the business of security so we could do better at securing business. But we still look at innovation. We still look at communication and leadership, all the stuff that we were covering. It just now lets us keep that really neat security focus to it. So that gives us that chance as we're talking with you. When you start looking at risk management, and even when you think about where you've been able to invest in your adventures, where do you look at the space? Let's start there. How are you looking at that space, and why does that matter to somebody who's watching the program today, sitting in an enterprise thinking about how to better manage their risk internally?
Excellent question. So, we have RSA coming up next week, and when you walk around, you're going to see all sorts of companies who help you reduce your risk, and I don't know what that means. After 20 years being in this space, it's sort of like, we all talk about risk reduction, cyber hygiene, but we don't have a set of standards that says, oh, you have to do this to be secure. If you do, it's compliance. And then we can have an argument, is compliance a destination or is it the starting line? It's really kind of difficult. But there's a couple things happening in the market right now. One is third-party risk. So we're having, everybody realizes if you have a company, you don't just have a network anymore. You've got all these other partners in your supply chain, you know, where you get your power from. Do that. How do you evaluate the risk on that?
I think Sears and Saks Fifth Avenue was a recent example of that, where they basically said it was a third-party chat service.
Absolutely. And then if you are making these decisions about maybe not running your own applications, perhaps putting them into the cloud, well, that's a dependency. Well, how do you evaluate the risk of that, right? Everybody can talk about, hey, there's a Windows computer, it misses this vulnerability. But if you take that application and you move it to something like Office 365, did you reduce risk? Did you transfer risk? It's a really, really difficult question. And there's been a lot of really interesting companies out there, you know, RiskLens One, you've got Cyvar, you've got different variations of this RiskRecon. You've got companies like CyberGRX that make the auditing side of this or the requirements of auditing your supply chain a lot easier. But we really don't have an opportunity or a set of standards that allows us to say, if you do X, Y, and Z, you can get cheaper insurance or you're secure or that sort of thing. And that's where we're at right now.
Well, I was going to point out is I've always loved insurance for that. And Paul and I have talked to a dozen people over the last couple of years, and I think that's where we get really good results. But you've pointed out something. I'm curious kind of your take on it, because you've been around the Beltway and you've looked at federal standards and you've grown the company around helping people figure some of these things out. Why don't we have a set of standards yet? Are we just not mature enough for it? Or is it that we have too many standards to choose from? Or our measurements are so crude that we just can't get there? Or is it something else?
It's a moving target. So you've got new technology. So, you know, when we started Tenable, nobody really cared about mobile phones. Mm-hmm. Now you've got cloud and you're outsourcing the data out there. And then the regulators are catching up. So now we have GDPR. So what was good 2 years ago is interesting, is not going to be relevant two years from now, or we're going to have to play catch up. And a lot of these really big organizations, they have 5-year, 10-year technology roadmaps. There's a lot of people who it's a big deal to upgrade to Windows 10 in 2018. That's the major thing. We're going to upgrade to Windows 10. And that's why it's so hard to then say, well, how do we fight nation state hacking? How do we stop, you know, infrastructure attacks, you know, from third parties? How do we stop simple malware? And it's tough. It's really, really a difficult problem. And it's okay if we said this is you need to look internally and do this. The best thing we've had is the NIST cybersecurity framework. The problem with the NIST cybersecurity framework is that if you do everything it says, your IT budget just tripled and it quadrupled. And you don't
never thought of it that way.
Yeah, you don't have it. And it's one of the reasons why people keep falling back to incident response and intrusion detection. It's easier to wait to get hit and find the bad person in your network than it is to try to prevent that.
But in this case, the bad person may not even be in your network.
Right.
And that, I mean, that, I guess that's my question when we think about, you know, we talk a lot about startups still on the show today and across the network, really, about it's exciting to look at the new cybersecurity startups. But if I think about it in the context of this conversation, I'm creating a new company. And sure, there's, you know, the whole investing side and your go-to-market strategy, but the IT side, creating a new company, I have computers for my employees. I don't really have much infrastructure anymore. And how do I, and do you look for this in your investing, like how do I do security today if I'm creating a brand new company?
If you're creating a brand new company, you have no legacy they have to deal with. You have no culture you have to deal with. You can kind of create things. And, you know, the great examples of these are like Uber and Netflix, right? These companies were created to take advantage of internet technologies, right? Mm-hmm. Google Maps, global positioning, mobile phones, you know, the drivers, the cars, nothing that Uber does. Majority of what they do, they don't own, you know, yet they were able to create this huge, you know, company that's out there. And we're seeing a lot of startups where they're cloud-based, they solve things like certain like APIs, they share data. The infrastructure that they need isn't supporting 10,000 global employees, right? It's not supporting you know, hardware, things that have to ship and stuff. So those new companies are definitely easier. For companies of 50 people and less, you know, what are their risks? Well, malware, mm-hmm. you know, physical attacking of the facilities. That's definitely an issue. But the thing is, it doesn't change when you get to the scale of a Citibank or the DoD. Mm-hmm. What changes that level is there's probably a lot of people who think about this a lot, and they think about it in terms a lot different than we do.
Mm. Are there certain strategies you recommend for people to assess their security architecture as it relates now to a lot of my services are either a service that's in the cloud and some of my infrastructure, maybe a lot of my infrastructure is in the cloud. How do I assess that and make sure that I don't have a breach, that I'm not the next Sears or Saks?
So you can never prove that. You can never prove that. And if anybody could, we'd be talking about it right now. So I tell people it's a good thing to ask, but don't like dwell on that. It's sort of like, you know, people who become hypochondriacs, they get really, really worried, and then they worry themselves to death almost, you know. So in cyber, I say, look, if whatever industry you're in, you have to be compliant. So start there. Prove that you're compliant. And it doesn't matter if you like compliance. You should be able to prove that you're compliant, and you should be able to have a conversation with your management about being compliant or not. Sort of the next level up from that is picking a framework. I don't care which framework, NIST Cybersecurity Framework, Center for Internet Security, you know, the Australians. I mean, there's so many different frameworks you can choose, but having a framework allows you to have a conversation with your management about what you're doing and what you're not doing. And you have to have that conversation. Maybe your backups stink. And in order to upgrade your backups, you got to buy a SAN or spend a lot more money with you know, Box or Dropbox or, you know, one of these backup companies like Druva or something mm-hmm. like that. And that's where a lot of people stay. But if you get beyond that, then the third thing is to actually have a conversation about the efficacy and the efficiency of your network. Mm-hmm. Are you spending too much money on your controls? Do you need 3 firewalls? And I've actually seen organizations, you know, how many forms of authentication do you need? Are you going to do some application consolidation? And then, you know, is your investment efficient enough? Like, you might have an investment and your incident response time, you might be able to go from a serviceable agreement maybe down to 72 hours, like what is required by GDPR. But those 3 different phases, depending on the sophistication of your network, being compliant, doing a framework, trying to then improve on what you're doing. A lot of people don't realize where they're at in that thing. And that's one of the problems we have with this conversation.
Yeah, it's not knowing what problems you have.
Mm-hmm. Ron, I love the advice. Pick a framework, any framework. Just pick something and then understand it and use it to advance forward. Do you think that we'll find then that as more people start to do that, that either the different frameworks start to look more alike, or we do find that there is a framework that's better for either certain sizes or certain types of businesses? Like, do you see that gets better, or that's really not that important? So just please pick any framework and let's get to these higher level conversations.
So if we were in the aviation industry and there was a whole bunch of airplanes that were crashing or were burning fuel and just they could carry passengers, we'd be like, okay, look, we need to start over. Right. But the reason why most airplanes look the same is because we've had almost 100 years of aviation or so, and we've got a lot of best practices. In IT, the tech keeps changing. Mm. And what we're trying to do is basically go to a network that's already designed, already deployed, already has a culture out there, and then trying to change that. That's a lot harder to do than designing a network. And if you go to certain networks like the process control people, you know, the power in the industry, it's those networks are designed to keep the power on. They're really reliable. They're resistant to, you know, a lot of everything from Russians to raccoons in some cases, right? But if you go to a large IT network that's, you know, maybe a major insurance company, and you go to another large IT network in a different insurance company, you're going to see a completely different culture, completely different tech stacks, and that's why it's so hard to apply these policies. So I don't think we're ever going to have one framework that's going to allow us to do that. I like defaulting to the NIST Cybersecurity Framework because you can talk about assets all the way to, mm-hmm. you know, recovery without being too, and you can have that conversation with non-technical people. And if you squint your eyes at like the SANs, the CIS, you know, top 20 controls,
sure.
They're pretty similar, right? So is ISO, I mean, they're all talking about knowing what you have. Do you need what you have? Are you protecting it? And can you survive an attack?
It's a starting point to build on, mm-hmm. not necessarily the law.
Right. But if you look at, you know, if you were going to go out and start, I don't know, a competitor to Netflix, and you were going to start from the ground up, you're going to build some security in it. You understand that. Mm-hmm. And some of the most secure networks have it built in. You don't see layers of antivirus and layers of that out there. In many ways, this movement to the cloud, it changes how we do and detect vulnerabilities. You know, if people who are all in on the cloud, they get the telemetry from the cloud, they audit the data, they look for that kind of stuff. Whereas people who have traditional networks, you know, VMs, full servers, you know, laptops, and that's, you're relying on antivirus, you're relying on EDR, you're relying on IOCs to kind of figure out what is bad. Whereas if you've built the network from the ground up, what is bad should be designed in and not let it occur in the first place.
Mm. Yeah, I like that approach a lot. I want to go back to the comment that if a business were to pop open the CSF today and follow it completely, their budgets go up. Because I think that that's not only a true statement, what I've loved about it is the accessibility. And I've started to notice that because we started talking about third-party risk management. And so what we're finding is there's a whole category of companies now that serve the Fortune Global 2000, let's say the Fortune Global 2000, and now they need to be compliant with somebody else's third-party risk management system, and a lot of them are very confused about what that means or where they need to go. And what I find is pointing them to CSF makes a lot of sense, but then they look at it and say, well, I don't have this, I don't have this, I don't have this, I don't, oh man, how do I even get going with it? Ron, is there an intermediary step in there, or is this an opportunity for companies? Like when you look at this type of thing as an investor, do you say, well, then that's an option, that there's an opportunity now in this new market space serving those third party companies? Or like how do you look at that challenge, both with your experience, on both sides of the desk for this one?
So if you walk into a large financial, large enterprise IT shop, they're going to tell you that things are good. Have you ever met a CSO who didn't say their network was good? Right.
Agreed.
But then you have a deeper conversation. And you say something like, all right, let's take the NIST cybersecurity framework. And I like to steal from Sunil Yu, right? Bank of America has presented to Gartner, RSA. And what he says is you need to take all of your applications and your people and your different types of networks and then go from asset management all the way over to recovery from the NIST, and then just fill in the blank with what is in there. And if you can't even fill in the blank on that kind of stuff, that's a great starting point without doing this huge assessment.
Yep.
Now, what tends to happen in corporations, though, is there's two types of security auditing. One is the self-assessment questionnaire, where I actually take a large number of questions and I go out and I say, Paul, do you have antivirus on your desktops? Mm-hmm. I don't ask you how many desktops you have, but you're the field security officer for Division X of the company. I say, Paul, do you do patching? Yes or no? Right? Do you have firewall? Do you have authentication? And I say, yes, 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 yes. And then I take all that data back and I bring it into my GRC, my risk management. And I have some sort of sense of what is out there. And then you cross-reference that with maybe what's actually on the network. Do you have Tanium? Do you have Tenable? Mm-hmm. Do you have a SIM? Do you have an asset inventory? And you try to measure those things. To me, an opportunity would be a company that could bridge those two things together. And Tenable kind of nailed the discovering what you have on your network and what's out there. I have never seen a company that could say, let's take that and convert it directly into some sort of risk computation. There's a lot of people claiming that they can do. What I'm telling you is that I haven't seen anybody who can really, really automate that.
Do you think it's because most organizations won't like the answer?
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
I mean, we've experienced that in Tenable.
Tenable,
sure,
absolutely.
Right?
I can remember when we were at Tenable, we would do basic things like, hey, if you scan continuously, you can start computing things like patch rates,
and
you could tell the difference between, are you patching on day 29 of a 30-day patch window, or are you patching continuously, right? Mm-hmm. Both of them say, I patch within 30 days. However, both of those organizations have completely different patch windows. That means I know that 29 out of 30 days, you're not patched versus these other things. So those kind of metrics, a lot of people hide. And another reason they hide them is because of compliance. If I know, this is very counterintuitive, right? But if you have an orchestration system, this is for your readers, if you go into RSA and you talk to these great orchestration companies, right?
Yeah.
Phantom.
Demisto.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And you ask, oh, can you highlight?
Oh, wait, our new sponsor, DF Labs.
The DF Labs, yeah. Amen. And you say, hey, how quick can you identify when some, I don't know, network connection happens to an IOC and enrich? Oh, real time. Can you tell me if I have a new port open on my PCI compliant web application? Oh yeah, we can do that. Customers won't deploy that though because they actually don't want to know when those compliance things are it causes a lot more work than those things.
And I've even had some, Ron, I've had some argue to me that it increases their risk. once it's documented, it creates a liability for them at the corporate and executive level. Do you agree?
I've actually heard that a lot. I've actually seen an interesting approach to this. It hasn't taken on a lot, but if you have the auditing done by your general counsel, not your general, but your law firm, right now that's done on attorney-client privilege and not necessarily done as a matter of record for your organization. And this is actually a really interesting thing, especially if you look at people testifying before Congress. When did you know? Like Equifax, when did you know? You know, and it gets really interesting at tracking that kind of stuff. So doing the right thing, doing the compliant thing are often generally two different things.
Mm-hmm. Well, so when you look at that gap, and so we've identified, I mean, like, so it's worth thinking about it. I like that idea of somebody who can connect those two things together. But as Paul pointed out, some of us don't want that answer. I think for some people too, it's a, and then what, right? And what would I do with it? And it, but I think there's a third challenge, which is, I don't need that. Why do I need that? That's what I'm for. That's why I have a job. When you're investing in companies and you're looking at the innovation in this space, how well understood does the problem need to be at the beginning? Like, does everybody need to get to the point where they look at that and say, yep, this is a problem. I need a solution. Or do you think that the right technology, the right company goes and figures out how to tell that story where enough other people go, oh, you mean I don't have to do all that? Okay, sign me up. How do you, when you're looking at that, how do you evaluate it?
So when I do evaluations of potential investments, it's a little bit simpler than, of course, we want the company to be effective. But a lot of times effective companies aren't sellable because you need to have a ability for customers to want to buy them and have a solution, a use case that really works. I'm also interested in, can we work with the team? You know, are they coachable? Do we have something to offer? You know, and that. But so when it comes to risk, we've looked at probably about 20 or 25 companies that claim to do some sort of risk calculation and make it easier to visualize risk. And about half of these people don't realize that people like Tenable, Qualys, Rapid shipped solutions in this space or features of those platforms. And the other half of the people don't realize how hard of a problem this is going to be to walk into a chief information security officer and sell them a product that they've been doing by hand or with Tableau or some other big data analytics thing from a business process point of view. So a lot of these risk products aren't really sellable. They're features, or they're not even features that are going to be acquired at some point.
Do they have to replace Excel spreadsheets too?
Is that there's Excel still really. Although I hear Tableau a lot more than
Tableau. So what is Tableau?
So I'm not a Tableau user. Think of it as a very very advanced data modeling spreadsheet.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Somebody from Tableau is watching this going, no. Business analytics platform, right. So
do more than pivot tables.
I'll give
just
you a good
tries out.
Yeah, I'll give you a good example. So so there's a chief information security officer who, they're a Qualys shop, and I was telling him all the great things you could do with Tenable, like the dashboards and Tenable.io dashboards and Security Center. And he's like, yeah, that's not our use case. We literally take all the data out of Qualys, we dump it into Tableau, and that's where we do our data enrichment and our asset, you know, pivoting and all that kind of stuff. And it's akin to, like, if you bring in a security vendor, they get to analyze all the data and give you the result. Some organizations don't trust that, and they want to go and do their own thing. And then the problem I have as a vendor is that sometimes, you know, you get this illusion of, I've done a good job. Like, I was on a discussion the other day where somebody posted probably about 100 to 200 fingerprints of web services on the perimeter if you want to do your own scanning. And I'm thinking, okay, that's useful. Everybody's real excited about that. I'm like, yeah, but the Tenable list is like 5,000, 8,000 long, right? Yeah. So how do you say, oh, what you're doing isn't good? Well, it's better than not doing anything, and doing something else requires you to change your processes. So sometimes, you know, bureaucracy and the complexity really gets the better of larger organizations.
Mm. Michael, more questions for Ron?
Because Paul doesn't have any.
Well, it's funny because
Ron's known me too long.
Well, and I find more and more that Paul and I tend to ask the same questions. But I was still just processing the stuff that you were just sharing there, because there's a lot of wisdom in that for people to take a look at. When you start making investments, so let's talk about that side for a second. First of all, why did you call it Tech Adventures?
It's not a travel agency. Right.
No, I was hoping you could book our next family vacation to the Congo or something, right?
in all honesty, so when I left Tenable and my wife Cindy, you know, worked at Tenable, and we were kind of looking at what everybody says, what are you gonna do for your next adventure? Mm-hmm. You know, and then she said that'd be a great name. And we were getting a lot of this. Are you gonna call it Google Capital? Are you gonna put a, and then of course, no offense to any venture capital firm that's got, you know, the vision of the guy hanging off the cliff, you know, and we're like, we didn't want to do that. You know, we wanted, it's an adventure. And when you leave your job and you have an idea, something you're passionate about, it is the biggest adventure. You have to recruit people to work with you. You have to you know, communicate your vision. You've got to go find customers. And if you're in cyber, you're fighting the evil hackers out there, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is the best adventure that we got going. It's better than any movie. It's better than any book that's out there. It's very, very exciting. So we wanted to call it an adventure and not just ventures, right? Mm-hmm.
Growing up, my mom, we never went on vacation. We always went on adventures. And I realize now it's because her sense of orienteering is not very strong. So as she'll say, we never got lost, but we had quite an adventure along the way. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you what, though. You know, Paul and I spend a lot of time, Ron, talking with folks about making the decision on if you're going to allow an investment and who you're going to invest with. And having somebody that's got that story who's looked at it that way, I like that. Like, I like what that signals. I hope that helps you stand out among others, but it helps you kind of find that connection. So to the second part of my question, as an adventure, you've got tremendous experience in the space. You know what it's like to start a company. I've clearly underplayed all of the stuff that you've done with Tenable. Are you finding that you like the space overall, or have you found that there's a niche within cybersecurity that is attracting you? And then within that, I'm kind of curious on what guides you.
Yeah, so at a high level, we've done about 25 investments, mm-hmm. and about a third of those we did, you know, as angel investors while we were at Tenable. And I thought it was a really good thing for me to do while I was CEO of Tenable, because it gave me a sort of a view over the horizon about what was coming, the struggles that these companies, you know, were getting, helped me, you know, guide Tenable. And that was a lot of fun. So now doing this full time, what I'm finding is we kind of split our investments into three areas. So hygiene, threat, and web application security. And what I've also found is that we've tried to go between very early companies, you know, pre-revenue, pre-customer, in some cases even pre-shipping product, all the way where we've been, you know, gracious enough to be invited to invest in B rounds and C rounds of, mm-hmm. you know, much larger companies like Contrast and Flashpoint and like Threat Connect. And what I found is that the view we have of the market, of seeing all these people, how they sell, who they hire, who they're working with, which biz development teams from larger companies potentially doing acquisitions are doing, what I've found is that we can be very efficient. And, you know, if I have a conversation with a potential acquirer, for example, it might be of interest in one company, but it's pretty easy to say, well, hey, what's on your plate? What are you trying to do for your company? And then we can talk about that. So when it comes to making investments, we're not only doing that from like 20 years of doing like Tenable and Network Security Wizards and working for the NSA. It's like, hey, for the past 18, 24 months now, we have been in the middle of most of cyber business. So I find it very exciting, quite the adventure. And it's a great way to be efficient.
What's your definition of a successful exit?
So when I talk to a potential investor, I ask them that question because I want to know what they want. You know, the second time we did a company, we did Tenable. I didn't want to do 2 years and sell the company.
Sure.
So if I'm working with a repeat founder, I'm going to ask, what are your goals? You know, I want to make sure I'm aligned with what their goals are. Do they want to raise a lot of capital? Do they want to focus on the technology? Do they want to create a change the way people do stuff? I just want to make sure I'm aligned with that, because there's nothing wrong saying, hey, I got a great idea to do a certain thing in cybersecurity better than anybody else, but it's really a feature, right? Nobody's going to say that on their website, but
sure.
You know, they're not out to create you know, Tenable Network Security overnight, right?
UEBA is the shining example,
sure,
today.
Sure, right. You know, so if there's like 1,000 products in this space, and they're the thousands and first, and their goal is, hey, we're late to market, but we're going to do, I don't know, AI, we're going to use the cloud, we're going to use crowdsourcing, you know, whatever the buzzword, that's their angle. If I can get behind that and I can work with them, I'm very happy to do that. I think that's a great way to think about it. And a lot of times what you'll see, and typically it's like Silicon Valley, there's like five of every major types of companies, and they're all invested by the major folks, and there's not a lot of differentiation. But and I'm like, good luck. So I'm trying to do stuff that's going to be a little bit different. It's got a little bit of a differentiator. And yeah, I've been pretty happy with that approach.
It's awesome. What advice do you have for those of us that are evaluating startups? You know, I mean, we do that level. We were just talking earlier, right? Like, we do that level to bring sponsors and partners onto the Security Weekly network. There's a certain evaluation criteria that Michael and I have been working on. It's kind of fun because I sometimes feel like I'm on Shark Tank when we do a. But also, if you're working for an enterprise today and you're looking for innovative technology, what types of things do you suggest that people consider when they're looking at startups? Yeah.
So the biggest thing is, if you're on the buyer side, is don't be bashful. So if you're taking a meeting with somebody and like 15 minutes into this, it's not rude to say, you know what, this isn't what I thought, I'm done, you know, and versus doing an hour demo.
Right.
Because you might learn something, but you really just wasted an hour. You waste an hour of their time.
Too, yeah.
Right. So don't be bashful. Mm-hmm. You know, be upfront. Say, this is my use case. If you can help me with this, it's really good. And so many startups, they're so smart. I mean, a lot of these founders have a vision and they have a technology. They have the ability to, maybe solve multiple problems. And they might not have figured it out. What's the use case that they're really trying to to do? So if you can help them do that, that's a good thing. Now the risk is, they're acquired by Cisco tomorrow. You know, the risk is they go into business. The risk is, the tech doesn't work. So there's a lot of risk with that. But most of the larger companies don't innovate, which is really, it's an interesting thing to say the larger you are, the harder it is to innovate. But that's because they've got products and roadmaps, and they're committing to 10,000 customers. And it's kind of hard sometimes for these big companies to come up with the next big thing. It happens. We thought we did it really well at Tenable, but it's something we were focused on. And a lot of times these larger organizations, they switch to just acquiring startups. So the question is what problem are you solving? And if they were acquired tomorrow, you know, can you still work with them? So again, not being bashful, can you buy a 3-year license of that product up front? Can you buy a 4-year license up front? Your money's probably going to be cheaper to spend that money up front with somebody and get the focus of that if you really like that. So I said, just again, don't be bashful.
One of the things that frustrates me with the speaking of acquisitions is larger company acquires some newer startup, and it might be one that collectively we were excited about, someone we took a briefing with, someone we talked to their customers, and they were like, this really helped us. I'm like, wow, it's exciting. And then the news hits and they're acquired. And the after the acquisition, I don't hear anything. I'm like, what's going on? That was really cool technology that could solve people's problems. Like, what happened? And sometimes you lose track of what happened to that technology, and that's frustrating. How do we deal with that? Why does that happen?
So it's interesting. This has happened to me a couple times. So when we sold Network Security Wizards to Enterasys, people are like, wow, it's like you guys disappeared for a year. But then we emerged and we were the Gartner upper right magic quadrant for intrusion detection. Of course, the year after that, Gartner says intrusion prevention is the thing, yeah. Right?
Richard said intrusion detection was bad, right?
Yeah. So the market moves really fast. And a byproduct of that is some of the technologies you deal with are irrelevant. And that might mean the company's not irrelevant. Companies go out of business all the time. Most companies don't make it to the to a big site. And then, are you a feature of a product you don't like? Are you a feature of a cloud platform you don't want? We've seen Amazon acquire some companies now. We've seen Palo Alto acquire some companies. And some people just, they can't do business with Palo Alto because they're a Fortinet shop or they're a Cisco shop.
Right.
You know, so there's all of these kind of things in the market, which is kind of interesting. Another one's open source. You know, is there a good viable open source alternative to do what you're trying to do? Maybe that's a disrupting factor. So there's a lot of, but it's really good to go to the startup communities. And I think that if you're in a position where you can't take meetings with startup companies, perhaps your city, there's a like you said, Shark Tank, you know, is there an incubator that does cyber? A lot of major cities have these kind of things. A lot of the universities have cyber. Go and volunteer and be a judge, be a whatever, give them that kind of feedback. And be honest, again, don't be bashful, right? Be honest about what you need, what problems you have, and you're probably going to get somebody who's going to solve that problem for you.
Michael, more questions for Ron along these lines?
No, I love that interplay. And that's one of the things that I hope that we're doing a better job on this program is both showcasing the challenges that people are facing as well as showcasing potential solutions and options and then saying, you know, go chat locally, yeah. Figure out the things that you think are interesting. I love the point about not wasting time, yours, theirs, or anybody else's. So if we could waste less time and be more articulate about the problems that we need solved and the problems that we're trying to solve, I think we advance quite a bit. Yeah. So that's always exciting.
Yeah, timing is a really, really important part of any business. Timing of the markets. Are people ready to buy something right. like this? And getting that timing right is so hard. And so I think it's really good for Phantom, I think, to be acquired by Splunk. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of orchestration companies. If they were sitting there thinking, oh, we're going to wait 2 more years, that might have been a bad decision. And that kind of stuff happens all the time in the market. As far as being efficiency, I think the last time I was on your show, I said, look, in a slide deck, brevity mm-hmm. is really the best thing. And a lot of times people want to hit me with like a 30 slide deck or a 50 slide deck. I'm going to look at the whole thing in 5 minutes, right, and that's right. the first impression. So you really need to have what's the one thing.
The one thing. We preach that on the show. It's something Michael mm-hmm. has talked about. It's something the sales books that yep. Michael's in all the books Michael have recommended yep. in their messaging, in all three of them, Michael, that we use as the pillar for a lot of our conversations, Play Bigger, mm-hmm. The Brain Audit, and Never Split the Difference. In their own way, they talk about really just having that one thing.
Mm-hmm. It's... a lot of time the founders, they're very smart. They're smarter than the average person. And they tend to think that the audience is just as smart as them, because most founders are humble people. And because of that, they bombard them with mm-hmm. a lot of slides, a lot of content, or they try to educate them about the market. And that's one of the things outside of cyber. If you're in cyber and you're pitching to a cyber investor, the worst thing you can do is say, oh, there's more attacks this year than there were last year, therefore buy my product, right? That's like the biggest mistake
that's a really good point.
If you're speaking at a business luncheon, sure, mm-hmm. go with that, right? But not to somebody who's invested in a lot of different cyber companies and been in the market for a long time.
Mm. Closing thoughts, questions, Michael?
Oh, I mean, we could carry on for a long time. I always throw these opportunities, and I hope you come back, Ron, and get to talk more about it. And I guess what I would ask is, are you cool taking questions? If people write into questions with us and they want to know more about it or whatnot, we can use it as a follow-up or maybe even chat with you, in between shows sometime and bring some thoughts back, because it's great opportunity. I'm learning a lot from this, and so that I'm hoping our audience is also processing at the same level.
Yeah, I'd encourage anybody who wants to drop me a note, hit me on LinkedIn. I'm Ron Gula on LinkedIn, and the website's gula.tech, T-E-C-H. And if they want to have an adventure, they can send a really long PDF pitch to me, and I yeah. will give them very good feedback. That's one thing anytime we say no, sure. we give a lot of feedback.
Yeah, then that's awesome.
That's great.
It's a great contribution to the community. Yes. Well, thank you so much, Ron.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, everyone, for listening and watching this edition of Business Security Weekly. See you next time.